It's just worth noting there's a bit of a gap, as you can see on the sheet, as to what we're doing next week. Well, I can assure you next week we'll be continuing the Psalms of Ascent in the evening, and in the morning we'll be doing a one-off on Psalm 73. But now let's come to the end of the Song of Songs. I'm going to read from chapter 7, verse 1 to the end of the book. How beautiful your sandaled feet, O prince's daughter. Your graceful legs are like jewels, the work of craftsmen's hands. Your navel is rounded goblet and never lacks blended wine. Your waist is a mound of wheat encircled by lilies. Your breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower, your pool eyes the pools of Hezron, by the gate of Bathraim. Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon, looking towards Damascus. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. Your hair is like a royal tapestry. The king is held captive by its trestles. How beautiful you are and how pleasing. O love, with all your delights, your stature is like the palm and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree and take hold of its fruit. May your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. May wine go straight to my lover, flowing gently over lips and teeth. I belong to my lover, and his desire is for me. Come, my lover, let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if the blossoms have opened, and if the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes send forth their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my lover. If only you were to me like a brother who was nursed at my mother's breast, then if I found you outside, I would kiss you, and no one would despise me. I would lead you and bring you to my mother's house, she who taught me. I would give you spiced wine to drink and nectar of my pomegranates. His left arm is under my head. His right arm embraces me. O daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, do not arouse nor awaken love until it desires. Who is this coming up from the desert, leaning on her lover? Under the apple tree I aroused you, there your mother conceived you. There she who was in labour gave you birth. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all the wealth of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned. We have a young sister, and her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister, for the days she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her. If she is a door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar. I am a wall. My breasts are like towers. Thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard to tenants. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. But my own vineyard is mine to give. The 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon, and 200 are for those who tend its fruit. You who dwell in the gardens with friends in attendance, let me hear your voice. Come away, my lover, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains. May the Lord bless the reading and the hearing of his word. Last week, as we were concluding chapter 6, We see in this very sensuous and erotic style of the book that the wife seems to dance for her husband. And then we get, as we've seen previously in the book, what's called a wassif. That's an Eastern love poem, which starts chapter 7. Now, I don't know about you, but there's something about dance, isn't there? I go through phases. I've been in a bit of a phase. It's probably because sort of at Christmas, you get various bits of money from relatives and you sort of look around and think, what's lacking in my CD collection? And I've been revisiting some of the older albums I just listened to years ago of Neil Young. You may know him, Canadian folk singer, rocker. And I got the album Decade, which is a sort of celebration of the first 10 years of his work. And great fun it is too. But one of the things that's interesting in two tracks particularly, one of them on that and another one, is that he seems to sort of see dance as something that's really tingles the senses. In Cinnamon Mongel, it refers to your baby loves to dance. And it's seen a very positive thing. And in fact, on one of the other LPs I've got, after the Gold Rush, the title of one track is When You Dance, I Can Really Love. Well, I think, looking at what we have here, the beloved, the lover here, the husband, would agree with that. He would really agree with that. Because what we have here is this very sensual, and it is, and I'll get onto it in a bit, but for those who still cling to the allegorical interpretation of this book, I think there's a particular verse here we have problems with if we took that view. Here we have a time to look. It's a time of appreciation. It takes the form, as I said, of this Arabic love poem. But these verses we have here, this picture in the first 9 verses of chapter 7, is him just admiring his wife and talking in very pleasurable terms. It's a lovely picture, isn't it? Earlier in chapter 4, he was looking at his wife and he lists 7 things. Now, 7's a complete number in Hebrew thinking. But here he goes further. He talks about 10. It's fullness, it's completeness. He's taking pleasure in beauty. It's actually, the Bible's great on this. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that at all. He's stimulated by it. There's been several illustrations to wine in this book. And it's always in the positive. It's quite interesting recently. There's a chap who seemed to... I seem to get his stuff on Facebook quite a lot. And he's, you know, Christian, obviously, and saying some good things. But he does have a bit of a thing about certain things, like King James Bible. And drink. Drink is another one. And so I rather cheekily just happened to sort of say, well, hold on a second. What about Psalm 104, verse 15? Wine gladdens the heart of man. The Bible has a lot to say about misuse of spirits, yes, but wine gladdens the heart of man. And that's the picture here, isn't it? It's a picture, isn't it? The wine goes straight to my lover. That's verse, second half of verse 9. There's a reference to her here, where he talks about... her navel was like a rounded goblet that never lacks blended wine. It's pleasurable. It's good to look. And there's an intimacy here. I think, sort of on reflection, I said there were some translation difficulties with the end of chapter 6, and you've got this curious bit where they say, come back. Come back, O Shumamite, this is verse 13. Come back, we may gaze on you. And basically, her husband says, no, this is for my eyes only. This is for me. And that's very, very, you know, wonderful. He talks, doesn't he, about graceful legs, or probably the translation is closer to her rounded thighs. This is very intimate. This is very, very special. And as I said, if we're still sort of hanging on to allegorical interpretations, I will refer back to a time I was discussing the book with a friend of mine, and he was very eloquently arguing for an allegorical interpretation. And so I said, hold on, what about Song of Solomon, Song of Songs 7, verse 7? Yeah, I'll read it out. Your statue's like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree and take hold of its fruit. May your breast be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. And it's rather interesting. He opened his Bible, he started looking at it. There was a period of silence, and he said, okay, this requires some thought. Yes, it does, doesn't it? But one of the things I'd like to emphasize is the rightness of this. The rightness in intimacy between a married couple. It's a lovely picture, isn't it? And he refers to her here as Prince's daughter. We've seen the imagery in the Song of Songs or Song of Solomon throughout. He's referred to as her king early on, and that later we work out he's a shepherd. We see her. I mean, even if people were making an argument for him being Solomon, and she is the Shumanite. She is just a commoner. But no, not to her. She's a prince's daughter. It's a lovely picture, isn't it? It's a picture of how husbands should see their wives. Guys, if you're married or contemplating marriage, I go back what I was talking about earlier about, I think it's Edward Taylor, the Puritan minister who said it was a book of hot emotions. And when he had young couples saying they were contemplating marriage or they wanted to get married, his first question to them was, do you love each other with a Song of Solomon love? That's a good one for marriage prep, isn't it? I have to use that. It's important, isn't it? Passions are aroused here. And you know, here we are. Here's the second level. That is how Christ wants to see the church. That's how one day he will see the church, isn't it? We've looked at this before. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25 to 27. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. That's how Christ wants to see his bride. It's a beautiful picture. And it makes her, there's benefits to this, aren't there? It makes her content and confident. The picture we get in the second part of verse 9, another reference to wine, as I said, is this, I belong to my lover, and his desire is for me. And the context, so she's talked about wine and pleasure. Again, the connection of wine here is pleasure. Flowing gently over the lips and the teeth is one of contentment. And it's the picture, isn't it, that we get. And Paul teaches. Paul was not anti-marriage. In 1 Corinthians 7:4, they belong to each other. The wife's body does not belong to her, neither does the husband's body belong to him. This is the picture here. There's a contentment, there's a satisfaction. So there's a time to look. Second point, time out. Look at verse 11. It's date time, isn't it? It's going back to the countryside. There's a lot in the book, as I said, some of the tenses in Hebrew show that you get flashbacks occasionally in the book. I don't think this is one of them. It doesn't seem to be. And so what I think is happening here, this is looking back. It's something I've always mused about doing. Maybe we'll do it for our 30th, love. But going back to, say, where we had our honeymoon. You know? Might be fun, mightn't it? See how the place has changed. But, you know, there's that sort of sense to it. Let's go back. Let's go back to that place where we first met. Let's have a long weekend. Time has passed. Let's have time for us. It's quite possible, you see, that the whole picture here is that they're married now for some time. Children, it's basic. Let's leave them with mum and let's take off. And there's a freedom here. There's not the coyness. I actually find the first book of the part of the book very interesting. It's playful in the banter between the two lovers. They're not married yet. They're getting to know each other. They're paying compliments. But this is now married love. This is no chaperone here. It's about going back. It's the woman again, and this was very interesting because as I argued at the start of the book, it starts on the wedding night and then we get flashbacks. It's her taking the initiative as she did here there. It's her saying, look, let's go. This is going to be a weekend of time out. But I'd also want to say it's going to be a weekend of passion as well. There I will give you my love. That's been very explicit throughout the book. And there seems to be, as they talk about mandrakes have a significance. They were seen as an aphrodisiac in the ancient Near East. There is a picture here of, again, lovemaking in the open air, which we saw back in 117, where it talks about, doesn't it, the picture of the beams of our house, our cedars, our rafters, our firs. That's pretty explicit. It's outside the bower here where the honeymoon is taking place. Now, again, we need to sort of get a perspective on this. This is intimacy. This is not exhibitionism. Some years ago, the church I grew up in, which I'm very indebted to and served in for some years, they had a Valentine's Day sort of preparation for the weekend, and they thought the vicar there, David Banting, decided to get one of his friends down who spoke on the Song of Songs. And when he got to this bit and other bits, he basically said, and traumatised one or two people in doing so, that him and his wife were not opposed to, when they were on holiday, to finding quite secluded places in the open air and being intimate with each other. Now, I don't have a problem with that at all. I do not have a problem with that at all. The picture that we're supposed to have, which was very predominant in the early part of the book and comes back here, is the picture of a garden setting, a country setting. It's supposed to remind us of the Garden of Eden. What do we see there? The man and the woman were made naked and they felt no shame. Shamefulness, the pathetic attempt to cover up with fig leaves, happens after the fall, doesn't it? Shamefulness comes in when the relationship with God is damaged through sin. And here there's a very innocence to the book, which is supposed to remind us of that. And they're keeping it fresh, both old and new. She's got everything prepared. I struggle with this. I want to say this coyly. Routine is not necessarily bad, but don't be ashamed to try something new, those who are married. I'll leave the rest to your imagination. It's about keeping things fresh, isn't it? You know, there is a danger, isn't there? They talk of couples getting into a rut, doing the same old routine. Can I say this book is here for a reason? If we're married or we're contemplating marriage, it's not to be routine. It is to be inventive. She has something special prepared. Now, it could be she's got a particularly nice meal that she'd had, but I'm going to guess there was something else going to happen after that. It's a wonderful picture, isn't it? But can I stress again the rightness of this? As I said before, the Jews would not have been able to... The Jews had a lot of problems with this book. They had a lot of problems with this book. They couldn't understand how explicit could be in the Bible. So they said, well, it's got to be about something else. It's got to be about God and his people. But one of the things they couldn't have contemplated, they couldn't even have contemplated an allegory if it wasn't a married couple, because they would have seen as sex belonging purely in marriage. So we have a time to look, we have time out, and now we have passing time and we have growing in love. There's a longing at the start of chapter 8 for greater intimacy. It might throw us a bit, well, does she really want him to be like a brother? You know, we've not had any indication of that in the book so far. Well, the picture here is of the Near East. It's still a very sort of taboo thing, for couples can't kiss in Arab countries. It would be seen as generally indecent, even if they're married. But you see, for a sister to kiss a brother, no problem. No problem at all. And she's saying, well, I wish we could just do that without this disapproval. I wish we just could express our love any time, you know, decently, just a kiss, a peck on the cheek. What would be the problem with that? But, you know, it would bring down a lot of, you know, disapproval on us. There's a lovely picture here, isn't there? She wants to continue growing in love. Even later, there's an urgency to this. There's a picture of security in verse 2 of chapter 8. Her mother's house. It's clear, I think, that they're married at this point. This isn't sort of doing it while mum's out. It's an idea of going back. The language, again, is very heady and sensual. And as they rejoice in their love, and as I said, I'm pretty convinced this is some years down the line, she thinks back and she thinks of this wonderful love she has with her husband. And she's basically saying in verse 4, it's worth waiting for. We've had this two times before. This is the third time. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, do not arouse or awaken love and throw it to desires. There's the picture. The picture is it's worth waiting and you can grow in love. It's a lovely picture. Love certainly hasn't cooled off to any extent at all. And then we get a reflection. The tense here changes and it's a picture, as we come into the last part of the book, of thinking back and the implications that now has for the future. There's a reflection on the early days. The picture in second half of verse 5, this again, verse 5 starts in a very similar way to the days of courtship when she was viewing him. And then we get this picture here under the apple tree, I aroused you, where your mother conceived you. It's another interesting picture of intimacy. And the picture we get here is a picture of awaken or being wooed, leading to, as we saw in the book, consummation of married love. And then we get to, I think, what is the highlight, in a sense, the peak of the book. Here we get an assessment. The woman thinking back, thinking about how they met, this long weekend or whatever it is being a great time for reflection and looking back and assessing their love, we get to these wonderful words. Verse 6 and 7, place like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love, rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all wealth for his house, of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned. The picture there is, in a sense, her thinking, and she finds it overwhelming. It's a declaration, isn't it? Place a seal. I am my beloved's, he is mine. It's a picture of cross my heart almost and hope to die. It's devotion. It's declaring devotion. Love is as strong as death. Death is all-consuming, isn't it? When we die, oh yes, we know that we will live on. But we know this body will rot. It will be consumed, won't it? It will go. Everything is consuming. Everything is overwhelming. It's extraordinary, it burns incredibly brightly. The NIV and most versions don't do justice to it here. If you look at more modern translation, the ESV, which tends to be more literal, in fact, you see you've got a footnote when it says it burns and blazes far like a mighty flame. In the Hebrew, it uses an abbreviation, it burns like the flame of Yah. An abbreviation of Yahweh. And so if you look in the ESV, it will say, it burns like the flame of the Lord. It's like a touch of the divine. Now, I think that's a good translation, and I'll tell you why. Because we see, don't we, that as he, just before this, jealousy is unyielding like the grave. There's a right jealousy, isn't there? Exodus 20, verse 5. He is a jealous God. Why? Well, he's got a right to be. He's got a right to be, hasn't he? Just think of what's happening there. We're looking at the Ten Commandments there, aren't we? Why were the Ten Commandments given? Because he had loved them. In Deuteronomy 7, he'd loved their forefathers. He'd redeemed them. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 5. It starts, I am the Lord your God. The commandments are, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. He'd redeemed them. He'd done everything for them. And again, we get that picture again, in a sense. What's that reflecting? Well, that's kind of, in a sense, sort of setting up the work of Christ, who gives everything for his people. He's a jealous God. He's got a zeal. John chapter 2, verse 17, when Jesus goes into the temple and sees the traders and he drives them out. And I think that's the start of his ministry. It seems he cleansed the temple twice in his ministry. It's the start of his ministry. And the disciples remember, they were saying to Zechariah, a zeal for your house will consume me. It's a jealousy. It's a zeal there. And it's a picture of love, isn't it? God gave up his only son, John 3:16. It's giving up everything. Love is consuming. The woman speaks of it and she says, it's all consuming. I give up everything for love. It can't be quenched. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. It can't be bought. You know, John Lennon maybe said a few daft things in his life, but he did say money can't buy me love. Perhaps that was McCartney, I don't know. One of them wrote it. But they did get that right, didn't they? It can't be bought. It can't. And here again is a picture, and this is why I think this translation of Yah is important. The flame of the Lord, it's a picture of burning love. And it reminds us of the burning love of God for his people. In a sense, I think that acts as a highlight of the book. But it keeps going. Thinking back, reminiscing over the years, they remember the opposition. The friends here, it's possible it's the brothers who were mentioned in verse 6 of chapter 1. The brothers were angry with her. And there's a bit of our little sister isn't ready to get married if we look at verses 8 and 9. And actually 10 and 11, she says, yes, I am, to simplify. Perhaps overprotective. As we were saying, and quoting Midsummer Night's Dream last week, the course of true love never runs smooth, does it? And sometimes families are not always as supportive as they could be. But in the end, love prevails. Then there seems to be one last distraction. I've made a case as I preach through this for Solomon not being the lover in this. I've made a case for that because I think whenever we see him in the text, he's mentioned 7 times, but he tends to be an intrusion. When we were looking at chapter 3, we noted that he seems to come in, he seems to be observed, he seems to be a distraction. And I made an argument for that, being that she looks at the beauty of Solomon and his wealth, and in the end she looks at that and actually she says, well, there can be distractions, but I've only got eyes for my husband. And here he seems to make an unwelcome intrusion into the text here. This business, undoubtedly Solomon had various vineyards he hired out, and she'd certainly worked in one. And here we get this rather interesting picture, but my own vineyard is mine to give. And we get this rather interesting thing. 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon. 200 are for those who tend its fruit. Now this is a bit which has big translation difficulties because people can translate it both ways. But as far as I can see, it's this. Because of the devotion we've seen, we have to always take scripture in context, so we need to look at what's gone before. Because there's been this such devotion spoken about in relation to the husband and wife, I think it's looking back, and it's almost like Solomon made an offer, almost a bid for her. As I said, the two lovers, they live in their own world. They have eyes for no one else outside that. And that's another reason why I discount Solomon as one of them. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. I don't think he could be that devoted if he wanted to add one more. The point is this. She says, keep your money, Solomon. Keep your Solomon. My vineyard is mine. I will give it to who I want to give it to. Again, there's a reflection, isn't there, of waiting for the right time and the right place. And love keeps growing, doesn't it? There's a picture at the end of continuing. Someone said the book's a bit open-ended. I think that's quite an interesting way to take it. There's a plea, isn't there, from the lover of, well, let's keep growing in love. Let me hear your voice. Let me get to know you some more after all these years. And there's still the playfulness of come away, my lover, verse 14, of literally almost run away with me. There's a picture of that wonderful devotion. I want to sum up with 2 things. I just want to quote this. This again shows how the book has been somewhat interpreted in the past. This is a quote, I think it's from John Piper when he did a series of sermons on the Song of Songs. St. Bernard of Clairvaux threw himself into half-frozen ponds to free himself from sexual temptation. He also wrote lengthy commentaries on the Bible's Song of Songs, also called the Song of Solomon, to prove it was not about sex, a feat without equal in the history of biblical interpretation for its foolhardiness. Brothers and sisters, we do need to reclaim the rightness of God's gift of sex and love within marriage. I actually think the church did a lot of damage in the 60s and 70s. When the permissive society came in, it was right that it preached against it. It was right that it reacted against it. But what I feel happened was we did not claim the ground. We didn't say this is God's gift. There's a rightness. Yeah, there's some rules. Why? To protect people. I think I quoted, and I don't know where I picked it up, but it was sometime just before I did the talk for Stony Words, that the majority of people, when they lose their virginity, regret it deeply. Now, here's protection. She looks back. She knows passions are involved. So she says, do not awaken love until soon. Wait for the right person, the right place, the right time. Marriage, right time. Do it this. This is God's gift. And in a sense, I think when she repeats it the last time, she says it was worth the wait. We do need to reclaim the rightness, particularly in these days where things are now getting so confused concerning sexuality. And as I was reminded last night, if I'd forgotten it, that it's being impressed on kids so young, there's no space. In a sense, I think it's interesting, isn't it, that the brothers are perhaps being overprotective, saying, is she ready for this kind of thing yet? But maybe it's the right concern. Apart from anything, let's let children enjoy childhood. One of the other things, and I think it's worth noting again, which I think is useful, is there's an element in this of when she speaks about going to her mother's house, she who taught me, there's an element there of instruction. I find it very interesting when you look at Titus. Now, I think this is something that needs to be reclaimed in this church. Titus 2, 3 and 4. Likewise, teach the older women to be reverent in the way they live, not to be slanderers or addicted to much wine, but to teach what is good. This is the key verse, which I think is very important. Then they can train younger women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled and pure, to be busy at home and kind and subject to their husbands so that no one will malign the word of God. What is that about? That's about purity in marriage. There's the line from the Woody Allen film where he talks about a psychiatrist who said, do you think sex is dirty? And he said, yes, if you're doing it right. Well, actually, he's got it wrong because it says in the Bible that sex is pure within marriage. There's a purity. Teaching. Wallace Benn once said that he had a load of young married couples in his church, and they were all coming and they were all needing counselling, all issues. And he said in the end, do you know what he did? He got them all together in one room and said, all right, let's talk about our problems, both physical, emotional, mental. Do you know what they were saying after about 10 minutes? Oh, we thought we were the only ones who went through that. You know, it is something. Christian mothers, instruct your children. Teach them what's right and what's proper. Teach them about God's wonderful gift of marriage and sexual intimacy. And secondly, and we must end here, what is God's intention for his people? Well, it's this. It's the metaphorical marriage, isn't it, at the end of all things. Chapter 21 of Revelation, verse 2, I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, dressed as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. And they will be his people, and he himself will be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eye. There'll be no more death, mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. That is where we're heading. It's a wedding. It's a unification. And rather interestingly, where does it take place? What does John observe? Verse 2 of chapter 22. Down the middle of the city, great city, street of the city, on each side the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nation. Do you see what would happen? It started in a garden, it's taken us back to a garden city. It's taken us back to unity with God. It's taken back to healing of the curse, and it says that there's no longer any curse. Let's take the Song of Solomon, Song of Songs, whatever we're going to call it, and learn its lessons. There is a rightness to God's good gifts of sex and marriage. But there's also going to be a day that through Christ's sacrifice, we will be unified. And we will be made, the church will be made the pure church. Not the troubled church we see now, sometimes struggling, but a pure church without stain or wrinkle. Let's pray.